Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I think most of you remember this man and this testimony before the United States Congress back a couple of years ago.
Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
That, of course, was Lieutenant Colonel, now retired, Alexander Vindman testifying. He is out with a new book, Here Right Matters, an American Story, that has just rocketed to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. And we're happy to be joined by him on the Bulwark Podcast today. So good morning, Colonel. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on, Charlie. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, I want to talk about the book. There's a lot going on. But as a former senior member of the National Security Council, I have to ask you what your thoughts are watching the events unfolding in Afghanistan today, because you worked in the White House. You worked at some of the higher reaches of foreign policy. You have a long career in the military. You are a veteran of Iraq. Just your thoughts about what we're seeing.
Sure. I guess I'd start with the fact that it's on a personal level, quite heartbreaking, watching these tragedies unfold in real time, and asking, you know, was it worth it? I was a veteran of the Iraq War, but there were, in certain ways, it's the war on terror, and I was part of that war. In Iraq rather than Afghanistan. And I asked myself if it's worth it. And the conclusion I come up with is nuanced, as you could imagine. The first thought was, you know, maybe not. But then I realized that we spent 20 years in Afghanistan and provided hope for millions and millions of people, and some prosperity and some peace, some respite from, what would have been an ongoing tragedy in Afghanistan. So on a human level, I take a little bit of solace from that. I also take some solace from the fact that we were beating back Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but mainly Al-Qaeda on far seas abroad, and did not give them an opportunity to attack the United States. That was a respite for the United States. So I take some solace from that too. But I also, you know, it's hard to discount the human toll, the blood and the treasure that could have been saved and spent to advance maybe more direct U.S. interests, meeting challenges domestically, and then at the same time, you know, being better postured to face off against my area of expertise, great power competition, you know, Russia and China as adversaries. So that's the nuanced, you know, I guess, view. And the last thing I'll mention is, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to judge that Biden did the wrong thing by withdrawing. I think in a lot of ways, a complete collapse without a U.S. backbone in some ways validated the notion that more time, more treasure, more blood would have been for naught. And the only thing we would be able to fall back on is the fact that, yes, we were fighting a terrorist overseas and we were providing some security for Afghanistan. But how long can we do that for in reality when we face enormous challenges around the globe? Where this administration fell deeply short is probably on execution. And this could have been done in so much a better way, where we didn't have a tragedy unfolding with the folks that helped us in Afghanistan. You know, the translators, the contractors, all those folks that were part of the same fight left behind. That seems to be coming together in a little way now. I'm sure we can't avoid all tragedy, but it seems like there's a plan in place to at least extract those folks and bring them to safety. So we'll see how it unfolds.
Well, one of the themes of your book that I certainly took away from it was, the deep professionalism of so many people who are working in the foreign policy area, in the military, the amount of talent, the amount of information, which then raises the question, how could they have gotten this so wrong? How could, you know, the world's greatest military, with all of the resources of the U.S. government, botch something that objectively speaking, is one of the most important decisions that we would have to make. How did this happen? I mean, you've been in the White House, you've been in the military, you've sat in the room, you've been in the tank, where the generals, you know, discuss high strategy. And I'm sure you've thought about this. What went wrong, do you think?
You know, a Sun Tzu quote comes to mind. Strategy without tactics is a slow road to victory. Tactics without strategy is a sure road to defeat. And I think really this has to fall, and accountability has to fall on the senior leadership that fell short, whether it was in providing the best military advice, the counsel required to indicate that this mission couldn't be successful, in some cases, false reporting on progress. I think you're absolutely right. And I think it comes through in the book that I have, you know, the highest esteem for the military and the public servants that serve this country. But the leadership sometimes isn't necessarily reflective of the institution. There is a kind of leader that seems to emerge, you know, a risk averse leader that doesn't necessarily make mistakes that would that nothing ventured, nothing gained. You know, a leader that potentially, you know, sees an opportunity to kind of take a middle ground and not kind of a risk career, risk post military, post government prospects, and offer the frank counsel that's required. And I think for me, it's hard to understand, because I think you could tell, you know, from reading the book, from my testimony, and from the fact that I've been dragged into the public, is that I've never been really, you know, fearful of that. I've tried to do it in a savvy manner, respectful manner. But if something needed to be said, I would say it. And I don't know if that's reflected in the you know, senior most echelons of the officer corps and folks that I know and worked with. It's a really hard judgment. But somewhere along the way, we need to be introspective about our shortfalls and ensure, you know, we don't let this happen again when the stakes are even higher potentially.
So you, I want to play for you a soundbite, because you're a serious man in a country that sometimes seems to be that feels quite unserious. That sometimes we're dealing with high public policy, but the reality is the decisions are made by petty politicians and by voters and commentators who have their own agendas. And I just have to throw this in before we go back into what happened with the president in Ukraine and in impeachment. I don't know whether many people caught Sean Hannity last night. I think this must have been on his radio show. He's talking about Afghanistan. And this may be the single worst juxtaposition ever, including the worst product placement ever. Let's play Sean Hannity last night.
How would you like to be in Kabul today as an American and you can't get to the airport? Where are you thinking your life is headed? If you're one of those family members, I bet you're not sleeping. I don't even think MyPillow can do it. MyPillow.com, that's where I go. I fall asleep faster. I stay asleep longer. No. There's going to be a lot of sleepless nights for so many of our fellow Americans. We got to get them home.
So he's talking about people fearing for their lives in Kabul, and he works in a MyPillow guy ad. Alex, damn, you can't make this stuff up. You know,
I don't know. I mean, I think Hannity's ratings have been falling anyway, right? He's in certain ways less competent and less radical. I don't know. That whole group of Hannity, what's her face?
Laura Ingraham.
Yeah, Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson. I mean, they're pretty sorry bunch.
Well, I want to talk about that, what their role in your story is as well. So let's go to the book, because the book is it's got several different layers. It is a quintessential American immigrant story. You describe coming here when you were 4 years old from the Soviet Union. It's a story of your military career. And for people who don't know, who think you just came out of nowhere, you'd been on a 20-year career where your rise was, I think it's fair to say, meteoric. You'd served overseas in Korea in the Iraq War, where you were awarded a Purple Heart after being wounded in action. You were a military attaché attaché in Moscow in Ukraine, and then you find yourself in the NSC. And so let's get right into this, because this all centers around the July 25th, 2019 phone call between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine, and you were the director for Eastern Europe, and Russia in the White House's National Security Council. So you're listening in on this call, and you knew right away when this call began that something wasn't right. You had a feeling that this wasn't going to go well. So tell me about that call.
Sure. So I was certainly apprehensive going into that phone call. It had been on again, off again in terms of scheduling. Ambassador Bolton, the then National Security Advisor, had basically tried to, kill the phone call, pull it, not recommend it move forward. The fact that it landed was in certain ways a bit of a surprise. And I guess I could recall thinking, well, maybe there's some gravy here. Maybe, Ambassador Bolton's wrong. Maybe this could land okay. And then it also didn't land. Usually you have congratulatory phone calls occur the day of or the day after, whatever the event is that drove the congratulatory phone call. It landed several days later. Turns out that it was because Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker and Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's now presidential head of presidential administration, and Mick Mulvaney, it kind of all worked out this drug deal. As Ambassador Bolton described it, to get the Ukrainians to open an investigation into the president's political rival, the one that he intuitively assessed would be the biggest danger going to 2020. So I guess that's to Donald Trump's credit that he saw the danger early and then initiated a continuing enterprise for the subsequent, year and a half, 2 years to steal an election. He was the one that tried to steal it. And I felt it in my bones immediately. I mean, I heard the tone from President Trump, and it wasn't anything like the first one where he's kind of a little bit, he was peppy and happy. He was low energy on this phone call. And I thought, okay, well, at first hearing just the tone that we weren't going to be able to bring this relationship to where I thought we could be aiding U.S. national security interests. But as the phone call continued, it went from, not helping U.S. national security interests to actively undermining U.S. national security interests and the president articulating a plan to steal an election.
Afterwards, you walked into your brother's office and you said, if this ever gets out, the president is going to be impeached. So, I mean, at the moment, hearing the president say, you can do us a favor, it hit you as you heard him say that this was potentially a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of in hindsight, it's a little bit astonishing that I had that. And it wasn't even prescient like that it was going to happen, but that I captured the gravity of the moment that, this had been such an overreach, such an abuse of presidential power that if it became public, the president would be impeached. I had no, and I ended up reporting my concerns through channels, never thinking that it was going to be going to be public. But of course, it did become public and the president was impeached for an abuse of power.
So there are a couple of things that surprised me in the book, including this. You get it. There was no recording, or at least we don't believe there was a recording of the phone call, but there was this transcript, and you had a chance to look at the transcript. And you said at that point, I had no idea, of course, that the transcript could one day be made public. But I can say now that the version that was released was not fully accurate. Right. So do we really still not know exactly what former President Trump said to the president of Ukraine?
I mean, I know what was said, and it's in the congressional record what was said. And it's possible like the actual, revisions to the transcript are somewhere in presidential records. Really, it's important to understand that, there is no recording of the call. I think my understanding is that after Watergate, they halted recordings. And what you do have is kind of like a real-time transcript that comes through. And it's not entirely 100% accurate in any case. And in this case, it was particularly important that it was. And, one of the reasons I took copious notes in my own personal notebook is that I could make sure I could to make the corrections that were missed in the, you know, the transcript as it was being taken down. So I attempted to include a couple of key omissions, including this reference to Burisma, because what that to me indicated was that, you know, Zelensky was prepped. He knew exactly what he would have to deliver on, you know, an investigation with wrongdoing pertaining to Burisma, this firm that Hunter Biden, you know, was on the board of, in exchange for a White House meeting and then a release of military aid. So those were, we do know what it is now. I've tried to correct the record both physically on the document and then subsequently, in the congressional record. So I think we're in good shape on that transcript now.
So it's extraordinary to read again because, you know, so much has happened and it's sort of easy to gloss over. But it is extraordinary to read again your account of Rudy Giuliani's operations in the Ukraine, trying to discredit the U.S. ambassador, undermine our policy. The fact that at one point the Department of what was it, the Office of Management and Budget put a hold on, you know, crucial military aid to Ukraine. I mean, this was a really big deal that you had military aid to one of our most important allies put on hold for political purposes. And you reported, and of course, this culminated in this phone call, and you reported it in up the chain of command. But as you write sort of just kind of dryly, the process did not go the way that I expected. You know, what strikes me is that you really loved your job at the NSC. And I don't think this is negative to say that you were excited about the prospect of being promoted to full colonel in the U.S. Army. You were ambitious. You had a very, very successful career. It was a very heady experience. And yet you repeatedly describe your decision to testify against the president as an easy decision, as one that you didn't agonize over, although you had to know that it put it all at risk. So describe for me why it was so easy to decide to go and testify when so many other people in the administration just, you know, couldn't bring themselves to ever do it.
So, you know, it's interesting the way you phrase that question. Because on one hand, there's an element of kind of personal ambition and wanting to continue to advance. And on the other hand was duty. And what I think my simple calculations were to put my duty above my own personal kind of ambition. And I'm just thinking through it because it was you phrased the question so wonderfully. Mm-hmm. That is an awesome thing that I could just kind of embrace, that I set aside my own personal ambitions to do what I thought was right. And that's what I want to teach my daughter to do. And that's what I think, you know, our leaders in the military, our leaders in government should be doing. And I was going to do what I thought was right and what I could live with. And in this simple case, the decision to report it was in fact super easy. I went that time it took me to kind of, you know, report it was the time it took me to walk across the street from the West Wing to my third floor office in the executive office building, you know, and walk into the legal offices. That's it. There was no like pausing and deliberating along the way. And at that point, I certainly perceived, you know, the risks of going down this road to my tenure at the White House, which I treasured. Every day was kind of like, you know, a little bit awe-inspiring that he's working in the hallowed halls of the NSC in the White House. But the more difficult decision in certain ways was entering, you know, the public consciousness by, accepting a subpoena to testify. I guess I really, in fact, had the option, if I wanted to exercise it, to hide behind, like many other people did, behind the president's dictate to not testify or not cooperate, and maybe in that way even advance like so many other people did, they advanced, like my fellow director, Chris Miller, at the NSC for CT, advanced to be the acting secretary of defense. But I just wasn't going to do that. I was not going to sacrifice my, 20 years of service and an oath to defend the Constitution against foreign and domestic enemies for personal gain, I guess.
So you had two career tracks, though, simultaneously. One, of course, was your position in the NSC, but you were also still an active member of the military, and you knew that this might jeopardize your position working in the White House. But it's very clear from your book, though, that you were taken by surprise by the fact that it also ultimately derailed your military career. So talk to me about that a little bit, because, what really comes through in the book was your expectation that the Army would have your back. And in the end, they didn't. And you had to make the decision to retire, which was a huge sacrifice. I mean, I just want to emphasize that, when people make these decisions, there's that moment when you're realizing that, you could be a colonel, you could have this very, very prosperous, wonderful, cushy career, but you needed to make a different decision. So talk to me about that, you kind of knew that your White House career was going to be over, but what happened to you in the Army came as a surprise to you. Is that a fair characterization?
That is a very fair characterization. I guess having served in the Army and embrace the Army values, I expected the Army to reflect those values back to me also, not just kind of in terms of, words and but also deeds, not kind of an expectation. There was a clear expectation that the Army should also live up to the same values that they expect of their officers and their soldiers. And, this is clearly an area where I think the Army fell short, not just to my detriment, not just to kind of the detriment of like good order and discipline in the military. It kind of cast a shadow over how the military was going to behave, but in some part could be justified if it was one officer being sacrificed for the good of the institution. But I think that proved hollow in that the president perceived a weakness. The Army and the Department of Defense buckled. He proceeded to parade senior military officers and defense officials out, after protests were suppressed in the summer of 2020 after George Floyd was murdered. And then, also kind of indicate that he would have military support as he tried to steal an election that he'd lost by kind of a landslide, frankly, 7 million votes. Mm-hmm. And I think they encouraged, the Army's behavior encouraged him. And the last thing I guess I'd mention on this, Charlie, is just, in my case, there was an understanding that like the Army may have sacrificed one individual, but there's also the perception that it acted politically by remaining quiet and not defending me. So this whole idea of remaining apolitical is, I think, proves a little bit hollow. And at the same time, you have guys like Charlie Flynn, I don't know him, but by all accounts, an exceptional officer that was elevated to potentially ingratiate with the Trump administration because his brother is Michael Flynn, President Trump's general, while my twin brother, and I were marginalized. And, my twin brother continues to kind of face that stigma, having less than the kind of the most prestigious assignments kind of being put out to pasture.
Yeah, I mean, one of the concerns, of course, is you end up at a radar station in Alaska. But also, what was clear is that they were holding, in order to prevent you from being promoted, they were holding up the entire officer promotion list. So it, yes. It was not just you; it was everybody else was put on hold because of the president's vendetta against you. Did you feel kind of, I don't know whether it was the right word, it was responsible that you needed to retire in order to sort of lift the shadow on everybody else as well?
Yes, in part, that is in fact true. I had every reason to believe that as long as my name was on this list, as long as I was on active duty, intending to maintain a military career, this list wasn't going to be move forward. It was delayed for months, and now, you know, there have been some officials that said, oh, that's COVID or some other reason, but the timing is just too convenient. I submitted my retirement paperwork on Wednesday. This process takes a year. People initiate their retirement a year in advance. Just getting the orders takes six months, and they processed it in 2 days. Once I had my retirement orders, the list came out. That is just too convenient.
They were really anxious to get you out the door.
Yeah. I mean, well, they were anxious to get me out the door, out of their hair, no longer casting a shadow over the military, and moving this list forward with, you know, hundreds of people that were on it and many hundreds more that weren't on it, but were trying to figure out what the disposition of their career was. In that same week, I learned, that was the subject of an investigation by the DOD IG based on, a completely fraudulent 6-point memo that indicated supposed wrongdoing, all entirely specious. And then the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, had called in the Secretary of the Army and Secretary of Defense and berated them for, you know, considering having my name on the list.
Amazing. Okay, let's go back to your testimony, that soundbite we played at the beginning of the podcast where you're addressing your father. I guess I had not been aware of how fraught that particular issue was for you. In the book, you describe a family scene took place during a car ride. You describe it as that was a tough car ride. Because your father, who had immigrated here from the Soviet Union, really did not want you to testify. In fact, was rather adamant about it. I'll just read you the paragraph you write. My dad suddenly began arguing with me. I must, at all costs, he insisted, avoid testifying against the president. His anxiety blew up, and soon he was yelling, "Support the president," my dad demanded. "Do whatever the president wants." He thought you were taking an uncalculated risk, that you were acting on impulse, placing yourself in a danger you didn't understand. So that's part of the context that I did not understand when I first heard you addressing your dad saying that you were going to be all right. But you had a very supportive family structure. But talk to me about why your father was so adamant that you were not doing the right thing by testifying against the president. Where did that come from?
You know, it might not come across, but, you know, I'm smiling as you talk about that. I love my dad. He's awesome. He has been such a prominent figure in our lives. He's 89. He's lived a long life and has an enormous wealth of experience. Really has a keen sense of the world around him, even though sometimes it's colored by like a misplaced context where a lot of that understanding comes from, 47 years in the Soviet Union. But he has a keen understanding of power. He rose to heights in the Soviet system, and he was counseling me from multiple different perspectives. One, he definitely perceived the risk to my career. Two, I think he was also channeling a sense of danger based on, his experiences, what could happen to somebody that speaks out against power in the Soviet Union. The cost would be extremely high, potentially loss of life, not just for me, but for the family and stuff like that. Certainly that would have been the case in the Stalinist era. Things have maybe slightly improved in the Khrushchev and Brezhnev and later periods, but we left in 79 when it was still Brezhnev was the leader. But so I think it was that. I think there was also early on a lack of understanding of the entire context of the president's wrongdoing and abuse of power that my dad didn't get because he wasn't privy to all that information. And really, I couldn't talk to him about it because it was in public yet. So the only thing I could do is indicate kind of the broad outlines of, what might happen to prepare him for it, just like I did with my wife. Eugene, my twin brother, had, of course, better situational awareness because he was on the NSC. He had, all the clearances. I could have, deliberative conversations with him, but my dad didn't. And for him, as a, former Trump supporter, he thought, how is it possible that the president had kind of abused his position and being so corrupt. And that may not have been all that far off from where I started. I was, you know, I wasn't necessarily a supporter of the president, but I had a kind of a reverence for the office of the president that in ways maybe even blinded me to the fact that the president was the driving force behind this whole quid pro quo until that phone call. Before that, I thought it was people trying to, you know, to serve the president's interests. So that was the whole scene that, you know, I guess I talked about.
But your dad was you describe him as a diehard Trump supporter, which I think would have come as a surprise to people when they were hearing you testify, that he was a diehard Trump supporter. And you say that a lot of members of this Russian emigre community became very, very Trumpy.
Yes.
Why was that? Why is that?
Very true. I think it's something that is preyed on, frankly, and exacerbated and inflamed. What you have is a group of refugees from communist authoritarian regimes that have gone through a trauma of the utter failure of communism and the far left, and their means of dealing with it is by rejecting communism and the left, even if it in the United States it doesn't resemble it, it's nothing near, you know, the left. It's a lot of pundits talk about, you know, Marxism and communism. The book that's on number one right now is American Marxism, which is a work of fiction, as far as I'm concerned. And it doesn't exist in America. We have a spectrum of liberal, even progressive policy prescriptions that fall well within established parameters for the United States. Okay. But that is rejected by refugees from the Soviet regime, from Soviet or communist regimes, and they probably hew too closely to the right. And they're further victimized by propaganda, domestic and external. So domestic, it's, you know, it's the Trumpy slogans about Marxism, but external, it's Russian money paying for Russian language programming to propagandize, you know, a vulnerable population. And that happens the same thing with the Cuban population, Venezuelan population, you know, South Asian population in the same way.
So let's talk about the fallout from your testimony, because I'm sure you were braced for criticism. But as you recount in the book, to turn on cable television and see people like Attorney John Yoo or Alan Dershowitz accusing you of being a traitor, or watching what was going on, you know, the Fox News hosts who used the phrase that the right-wing media led by Fox News was in a rage to demolish my reputation. This was really quite something, and it continues. And I want to get your thoughts on this. You're someone who, very clearly, you've served your country. You're clearly a patriot. You have been wounded in your country's service. You did what you thought was right. And the vilification has been truly extraordinary. So how is that to bear up under? I say this because I think that sometimes people think that, well, I saw Alexander Vindman in uniform. You know, he was on television, everything. What I think they forget is that you're a real person who goes home to, you know, your wife and your daughter and your dog. And you realize that and you're being trashed in the most vicious possible way. That's got to take a toll. That's got to be immensely frustrating.
Well, I tend to be somewhat kind of analytical and thoughtful. And what I focused on is, you know, I could relatively quickly discount these you know, nutty pundits that are looking to, you know, attack me for ratings. But the second and third order effects of that included magnifying criticism from the American public and you know, putting my family and myself in some sort of danger, because that you know, that would generate you know, threats, frankly, to be speak. But I also assessed that this was the tipping point for me no longer being able to do my job and serve successfully overseas, because you have to remember I'm in a very trusted position, and I'm serving in hostile environments in Russia. And part of the calculation for them and their security services is this person vulnerable? Is there an approach that we could make to kind of compromise this individual? And certainly our own counterintelligence folks would weigh that in approving or clearing my assignment to these places. So that was the first thing that I knew that the cost was going to be not just some words, but in fact, consequences of those words on me being able to serve overseas. And then the other thing that was really striking is that this was in a lot of ways out of the Russian playbook or the authoritarian playbook, where the best that they could do is they couldn't attack the facts. So they attempted to attack the character and of the witness, and basically, the interesting aspect of that is that they thought that this would be an effective way to neutralize my factual testimony, that they could, counter accuse me of wrongdoing or some character flaws, when the president of the United States is probably one of the most flawed characters that we've had in this as a national leader, maybe in our history. I mean, stacking me up against the president, I can't see how anybody with any kind of with any presence of mind could say, well, this guy is, this guy served his country in decades of military service, combat, and then the president that was purely self-serving the entirety of his life. Part of the mission of this president is to profit through dividing this nation. That's the part that I find hard to swallow, that you have Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, profiting from this kind of narrative.
So the president is impeached. He is acquitted. And immediately, within a couple of days, was within 2 days, he fires you and your twin brother from the NSC. But you were expecting that, weren't you?
Of course. It was a notoriously vindictive administration. In certain ways, I was a little bit surprised that I wasn't fired after my public testimony. And then, of course, thinking through why, it was clear that the president was going to wait until after the Senate trial. And then, maybe there was a little bit of surprise that the Senate trial ended on Wednesday. I thought I might be out by Thursday. But of course, everybody knows that firing day was on Friday. And that's when, people get fired at the White House by tweet or whatever other means. So it made perfect sense. I walked out of there kind of, not carrying boxes or anything like that. I was, and with a sense of relief that I was out of the lion's den.
And of course, now the question is, whether you are in fact are all right. I mean, you said, don't worry, I will be all right. So are you all right?
Maybe not entirely, but I have every reason to believe I'll eventually be all right. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do. I'm engaged in some pretty awesome activities, still being a public servant, but just out of uniform. I'm in advocacy for other public servants that have served this country honorably and served as guardrails during a particularly disastrous administration. I have been writing extensively on national security issues. I make it a point to address leadership that fails to live up to their values, and I'm going to continue to do that moving forward. Whether that's directly using my own voice or through support to vote vets or Republican voters against Trump or Democratic candidates, whatever the case might be, these folks I will not forget that they imperil this country and national security. And I'm also working on a doctorate in international affairs from Johns Hopkins. I'm on a think tank as a senior. I'm part of Lawfare, a DC-based think tank. I teach and guest lecture. I'm on the board of an NGO, the Renewed Democracy Initiative, which is geared on looking for solutions to make this democracy resilient. So I'm doing all sorts of things. My wife says I have like 6 jobs now, but I haven't quite figured out what to do.
Yeah, I mean, you also have this New York Times bestselling book. So, I mean, there is that. And then, of course, you've left out the two most important things that have happened since. You got a dog. And people ought to know that Alexander Vindman and his wife, Rachel, are dog people. So you got Ace. So tell me about Ace.
Ace is he's a pandemic puppy. We figured out that he was born, I think, the day of or the day before I was fired from the White House. And we collected him up. I think it was in, I guess, late March or so. And he's a terrific dog, a year and a half old. He's a German Shepherd, Australian Shepherd. So he's not as big as, he looks like a German Shepherd. He's just not as massive. And he's a great dog. And we have a second dog, a lab greyhound, Boots. And that's part of the family.
Ace and Boots.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that the famous line that if you want a friend in Washington, D.C., you should get a dog? So, I mean, trading working at the Trump White House for having a dog. I mean, this seems like a significant upgrade in lifestyle.
Yes, it is. But I know, Charlie, I think it should be mentioned. You know, I said I was OK, but there's just an enormous amount of unpredictability where there would have been certainty. You know, if I had just kept my mouth shut. I would have been a colonel. I would have graduated service college this summer. I would have been able to serve in high value assignments that would have, I think I could have contributed to enhancing U.S. national security. I did some pretty fantastic things, including authoring the most critical documents on facing our challenges with regards to Russia that are the documents of record. So I think I could have, that would have been the certainty. Now I don't know what I want to do. And I'm a lot more lucky. I'm a lot luckier, rather, than other whistleblowers that have not been able to land on their feet. And there's really only cost associated with being a whistleblower. There is no magical Hollywood reward or anything like that. It's only cost.
You know, and this is a very important point. And so, I mean, obviously, there's. You know, there is the opportunity that you might be able to return to public service at some point. I mean, if another White House were to call you back into government service, into foreign policy work, you'd be open to that?
I think I might be, but the problem is I perceive that this administration is both too busy with a full plate, legitimately, a full plate of foreign of this real environment of a national security peril. It hasn't adequately addressed the misdeeds of the past 4 years. So they still have, they're falling short on accountability. So that's two major, major items, all of the domestic policy agenda. And they're probably too risk averse in terms of, wanting me to join because that's just going to, why invite that on yourself when you have all this work to do? So I don't think that's in the cards for me, unfortunately.
Well, of course, as we all know, we don't know what's in the cards for us. I have to mention, though, that it's also interesting watching. You mentioned your wife Rachel extensively in the book. The support and the encouragement that she's given you, she has become quite a prominent fixture on social media as well. So one of the benefits of all of this is that your feisty wife is out there. Are fighting the good fight on a regular basis as well, and that's got to be interesting for you to watch that.
It is. She's I initially said that she was made for Twitter, but frankly I think Twitter was made for her. And it's pretty awesome the way she's used both of us to a certain extent, but we've used our voices to kind of advocate for the things that are important to us, accountability being one of the most critical areas. We have a pretty darn good family life, even with the unpredictability, which has been nerve wracking for both of us. We have a wonderful daughter. The book is, in a lot of ways, we focused on kind of like, some of the high points, but the book is really about, our family life, how Rachel and I met, the critical moments in my background that I kind of, looking retrospectively, determined were formative in the person who I was and how I navigated the impeachment. That's really, what it's about. It's in a lot of ways a very kind of uplifting story. So for your listeners that were thinking about buying American Marxism, maybe they should buy something that's not fiction and, come out maybe feeling a little bit better about this country, because I have some perspectives on that.
You know, it's interesting. As I was reading the book, you know, the phrase came, you know, kept coming back to me. You know, this is really the quintessential American story. And then, of course, I closed the cover and realized that that, in fact, was is the subtitle. The book is Here Right Matters, An American Story. Alexander Vindman, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army, retired, on the New York Times bestseller list. A fantastic read. And as you point out, not just for the politics and the analysis, the extraordinary story of the first impeachment of President Trump and the attempt by the president and his cronies to corrupt the U.S. election, but also just a story of service and of moral courage. So, Alexander Vindman, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on, Charlie. I appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.